Whew, that was a close one.
It's time for the One More Bucket podcast with collegiate golfer and instructor Blake Doss.
And his old man who likes to tell everybody he taught him everything he knows.
Bobby Doss. It's One More Bucket. Take it away, guys.
What's up, Dad?
Hey, Blake. How are you?
Fantastic, as always.
This is episode one. We're calling it round one, the early days. As we think back on Blake's golf career and all that he's accomplished, we really are learning a lot about what we did early on. And this is an episode where we wanted to start sharing some of the things that we did as a father-son team to help Blake's early career. We really didn't know what you were going to do with golf, did we?
Not at all. When I first started, I did not have any, I don't think, like long-term goals. I didn't consider playing in college a thing at all. I just kind of picked it up, wanted to make the high school team, and then sort of go from there.
Yeah, and the high school team, we weren't even sure that was realistic. Yeah. We didn't know anything about high school tournaments, high school teams, high school anything. We learned a lot, and we'll probably share that many times over in future episodes. But we really didn't know where Blake was going to go, but we knew that he wanted to get better, and that was kind of one big thing. We knew Dad didn't want to rush it, meaning I didn't want to try to make Blake be Tiger Woods in the first 6 months. That would have been impossible and no fun. And then we knew that we needed some sort of a plan. I'm kind of a little OCD. I'm type A. I wanted to build a plan, but I know Blake's not. So I also knew I had to balance that somewhat. And so a lot of what I was doing at the time was just trying to make it fun. Do you remember, this was summertime, it was really hot, we were doing the drive, chip, and putt, and we live close to a golf course that we're members of, so we just spent a lot of time on the back range. Neither one of us knew what we're doing. Hopefully there's a lot of dads and sons and dads and daughters and moms and sons and daughters listening too that are in the same boat we were in, right? So if you're going to the driving range and you don't know how to build that plan and you don't know what to work on, hopefully you're going to get some of that today. Today's show is broken down into three parts. Tell us about what three parts we're going to talk about today, Blake.
We're first going to start by talking about what I did to kind of get better in my early days. Obviously, that changed a lot, and like the ways I was practicing and what I was wanting to accomplish changed a lot as I aged and got older and got better. We're also going to be talking about just goals that I had or like little motivators I had at, once again, kind of that young of an age and at my when I was just starting and picking up the game. And then we'll also talk a little bit about my accomplishments and just things that I did that put a smile on my face when I was that young. And it could literally just be as simple as hitting a ball flush when that was just such a rare thing to happen. So, yeah.
I was going to say, don't give it away. We got to wait for that part. You can't.
True.
So let's talk a little bit about getting better early on. And we did experience this, and I'll try not to say it every time, but we're going to go from early on, like round one, all the way to the end of your time in high school and into college. The progression was much faster early on.
Right? Oh, yeah. A lot.
It was a lot easier to gain 5 strokes around in the first 6 months of your career than the last 6 months of your time in high school. And so I think it was natural to feel excited and to make that motivation. You know, we might one day shoot 12 on a par 5 and come back the next day and make a 7 and it would be the same hole.
Yeah.
Then the next day we might make another 12 because we lost our mind or whatever. But there were things we did early on to get better. I can remember this like it was yesterday, that I kept telling you there's no way I can teach you everything in one range session. There's no way that this 1 month I can share everything. I think I told you it was going to take years. And I remember in your sophomore and junior year telling you, we're not even halfway there yet, kid. Yeah. And your coach saying the same thing, right? And we probably aren't still all the way there. We've still got a lot to learn. So how do we, as a father-son, who may have butt heads from time to time, how did we go about breaking it all down? Do you recall?
I mean, I know we did things to keep it a lot more simple. And like looking back, we did just like what we were doing was all just very simple things that like I was trying to accomplish. And like to me now, obviously it's just very easy things that I could do pretty easily. But back then I kind of had the same thought. Like I thought it was all very easy, But like I couldn't do it. Like I didn't have the skill to do it. So we did just very basic things and just, I think, try to keep it simple rather than
The analogy that I think I would use is we were crawling and we walked and then we went back to crawling some.
Yeah.
We walked some. You know, junior, sophomore and freshman year, we really never were at a run for sure. We were still taking baby steps trying to learn these things. It is a mountain of stuff. And as you get better, you think you can do things that maybe you really still shouldn't do. I can remember talking about probability a lot back in those days. And I don't even know if in ninth grade you really understood probability. But it was always about, is this going to give you the best next chance to hit the next thing you're going to have to hit?
Yeah.
And again, when you're making 10 and 12s on holes, man, if you could just do one shot better, that's 10%. That's 11% better. So we were always talking about, look, yes, we only have 140 yards to the green, and maybe if you hit a perfect 5-iron, you could get there. This, again, being when you were, I don't know, 14 years old, 15 years old. And we would say, but if we laid up, we took all that sand out of play, because I remember sand was a big demon in the early days. How do we take the sand traps out of play? And we would often argue about that a little bit, and you would want to go for it.
Yep.
How did that turn out a lot of the time?
Oftentimes when I did like try and do my own thing or go for it, I mean, I'd quickly learn my lesson because I would pump it in a sand trap from like 150 out and then probably be in the sand trap for 3 or 4 more shots because I did not know how to play it out of a bunker that early on, obviously.
But you probably could put a wedge on the ball in the grass, right? And I kept trying to teach the simpleness of, look, staying out of trouble is going to make you a much better golfer, even later in life. And way down the road, me playing golf in the club championship, boy, if I can avoid that hazard. Now, there's times where you got to go for it. Mm-hmm. You got to be a little bit more aggressive. But each of those things, we learned about it. We learned more about it. There were things that I don't think young golfers should even be worried about, but the fat part of the green or the flat part of the green or the safer side of the green, being below the hole. Like there's a lot of things that you have to do that I think it's best if parents and golfers try not to get too technical. You played with a couple young guys. We're going to talk about them all the time. Andrew, Matthew Spaulding, good friends of yours still today. Mm-hmm. They were very much more technical than you. They've been playing since they were 5 or 6 years old. And sometimes I would cringe when I would hear them talk to you because they were at a stage in their career where they were much further down the road. Yeah. And they were talking about a technique or a tactic or an approach to the game that you weren't ready for.
Yeah.
But what would you do if they told you about it?
I would try it, obviously, of just because, like it just...
They made it look simple.
They made it seem like, oh, this is the best thing to do. This is the easiest thing to do. Just like go and do it. But for where I was at the time, being as young as I was and as new to the game I was, like literally I look back and the only thing I should have been worried about is just like hitting it in the fairway and hitting it on the green, not like worrying about anything, kind of any outside factor other than that. And I think I definitely did fall victim to like trying to do more complicated things that I just definitely was not ready for.
And I think we came up with a number of things that made it easier to do that. Mm-hmm. One of the things we did early on was we would incorporate a game. Sometimes on just 3 holes, we would play 2 balls. Yep. I would let you play 2 balls. And the purpose of that was not to show you how good you could be playing a 2-ball, 1-man scramble. It was quite, and I still believe it's true. So whoever's out there listening, if you go play 2 balls, I bet you'll play the first ball more often than you normally would think you would.
Yeah.
Because you have no pressure simply because you know you can hit one more ball.
Yeah.
And so we played 2 balls and you could probably play closer to par in those early days, even if we were playing the up tees, because you had a lot less stress.
Yeah.
And boy, we'll have shows on the mental game, but 2 balls gave you that ability to have less stress.
Yeah.
I also think playing 2 balls makes you a much, much better putter.
Yeah.
Why does it work that way for putting?
Well, for putting specifically, obviously you putt the first ball, you get immediate feedback as to what the line was, as to how fast the putt is, literally like everything, how it rolls, everything. And then from there you just adjust, and then you can putt the second ball on basically what you should perceive as like the perfect line, because you just got a perfect read. But yeah, I think another thing two balls also did for me a lot, you kind of talked about how I feel like the first shot was always better, but I feel like a lot of the times too, like we talked earlier already, I would always kind of try and go for greens and like hit it in bunkers and then quickly learn. And I think when I was playing two balls, I would make kind of the dumb decision on the first ball, see that I couldn't execute on that, like what I just did. And then that would quickly like bring me back and be like, okay, you got to do something smart here. And so then it kind of taught me how to just play smart, because I was playing two balls, obviously. And obviously if I executed on that one ball where I had no pressure, I would then go play that. But then more often times than not, I would make some really stupid mistake with that first ball, and then I just drop another one down, play it to the simple, more smart decision, and then oftentimes the result would be a lot better as well.
Yeah. One of the things I remember, because it was a silly tactic that I helped you with, was really learning how the ball flies differently off of different lies, right? And whether it was deep rough, sand, a thin lie on the fairway, not concrete, but, you know, hard pan, like yeah, in the under a tree where no grass is growing. I kept trying to teach you things, but tried not to be too technical. On side hill lies, which is, they're quite often found in our home course, I didn't know how to tell you which way the ball was going to kind of jump. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what the trick was to do with that?
I remember our trick. Just to explain for everyone, usually when the ball's kind of above your feet or it's kind of on a hill and you're standing below the ball's going to most likely shoot to the left on you for a right-handed player. I don't know if that makes a difference, but...
It's going to jump away from the hill.
Yeah, it'll jump away from the hill, and then vice versa. If it's below your feet, so it's down the hill and you're up above it, it's going to jump away from the hill still. It'll go to the right for like a right-handed player. But the thing we did is I would take my left arm and I'd put it the direction of the hill, and then basically I'd take my right arm and then just make an X with my like arms basically, and I knew left arm was the direction of the hill and then my right arm was where the ball was going to go. And so literally it is a very simple thing, but I just never could remember where it was going to go like that early on. And so I was literally doing it just every single time I'd get on a hill, just like quickly put my hands up and be like, yep, it's going to the left, or yeah, it's going to the right. And that was just like one little thing I kept reminding myself. Cause like you said, at our home course, there is like a lot of hills, like just little hills, nothing like extreme, but I would just often have to remind myself that, just little things like that.
Another interesting one that I think, I don't even remember where I learned it, but I know I showed it to you, and I can remember seeing you doing it, and I'm not even sure it's legal. We'll have to do a rules show sometime too, but I showed you that if you would lay a club down and step on the face of the club, you would kind of have the default trajectory of the ball.
Yeah.
And you would often ask me, can I get over that tree?
Yeah.
And I would just say, check it. And you'd put a pitching wedge down and stand on the pitching wedge, and the shaft of the club innately goes upward towards that direction. And it's I don't know if it's exact, but it's probably fairly close to reality, and give you an idea of whether or not it's going to help you get over that. You know, you put a few hundred of those ideas or rules into play. There's a lot to learn about the game of golf and how to get better and how to learn those things. I think from the older pros, they all believe grip's important.
Yeah.
I think I knew grip was important early on. I think you had a horrible grip early on. We had many a debate and argument. And
had a little baseball influence.
You were a little baseball there. And so you did not want to interlock your fingers. No. I have always been an interlocker. I've tried overlap and it just doesn't feel as connected. We played with a few different variations, and you would hit two balls overlap and then go back to baseball grip. You'd hit two balls interlock, you'd go back to baseball grip. And this went on for we'll call it 10 days. It was a short period of time where you weren't really committed. You felt like you had more power.
Yeah.
What did we do to kind of settle on a grip?
Well, I remember interlock was always just so uncomfortable for me. And you would continually tell me, like, it's what everyone does. And I just, like, I didn't even believe you because I was just like, there's no way. This is so uncomfortable.
I think I have a video of you saying, I cannot do this.
Yeah, probably. Like, it was just such an uncomfortable feeling for me to, like, interlock my pinky and my index finger. And then finally, you're just like, Blake, you have to interlock. Like, you're at that point now. Like, you have to learn to interlock. And I was just like, okay, whatever. And then you're just like, hit one bucket, and you, I don't care how it ends up. I don't care what happens. I don't care about any of the results of any of the shots. Just hit one bucket where you interlock every single swing. And I was just like, whatever, I'll do it. Kind of like just to make you happy. Like, I was just like, I'll do it. And then I knew I was just going to like switch back. But I hit the one bucket, and then all it took was one bucket, and it became, it felt comfortable. Like, you just kind of, I just had to get over that just initial, like, little hurdle of just, like, a tiny bit of, you know, uncomfortness, and then it became very comfortable. I think more often than not,
it feels weird.
Yeah.
And I would say a lot of times in the game of golf, when it feels weird, you're probably doing it right, because you're getting out of an old bad habit or out of an unnatural way of doing things, and you're probably getting to a point where, not always, but more often than not, you're probably leaning more towards the right direction of it. So when you said, I cannot do interlock, I knew that you could. There's thousands and millions of golfers that do interlock. I wasn't sure it was right for you, but I knew we had to pick one way to get connected. The whole reason that the grip is either interlocked or overlapped is so that both of your hands feel as one. They come together as one, and they hold the club the same way. I'm an interlocker. Most kids do what their dad does. And we made him an interlocker. It was probably not too long ago I asked you to hit one without being interlocked. How'd that feel?
I mean, I probably, the confident kid in me saying I definitely like did it, and I probably hit a perfect shot, but it definitely just feels, I've done it as a joke a couple times, like not lately, but just like in the past, and yeah, just it feels so off. And even I'll play baseball with my buddies still, and my first just initial reaction is to interlock on a baseball bat now.
That might break your finger, don't do that.
Don't do that. But it's just, it's crazy how much like it's ingrained in me now. And like literally I'm holding a pin right now, and I was just doing it on the pin just because like it's just, I've done it so much and it's just so ingrained in me now. And
well, you've probably
stuff
hit
like that.
Maybe close to a million balls. It's hard to go back from that at this point. So number two on the agenda today is having some goals. And I don't know that they were goals early on as much as they were maybe motivators. And it was always to, and for me as the coach to Blake, was really to try and start thinking about ways to get him to think about course management, other things. But what were some of the golf motivators that you had early on as a junior golfer?
I remember a couple of the motivators that kind of motivated me to like continue to practice and things like that were definitely just beating you. Like, I just wanted to be able to one day hang with you, beat you, and like play golf with you. And then others were like you said, I played with really good teammates, and it was just also like trying to get to their level. Like, it, a lot of it was just like trying to get good enough to where I could like be as good as these people I was playing with all the time. But then more like short-term goals and more like course management goals that I would say that I was doing is just like when we would play, I would hit it in the rough a lot, obviously.
Everybody does.
Yeah, everyone does it. And I remember you just telling me like, Blake, just hit it back in the fairway. Like that should be your only goal right now. You shouldn't try to be doing anything else. Just like get the ball back in the fairway. And like you were not saying just like completely hit it 90 degrees left, like just back out to the fairway.
Oh, I probably meant that back then.
You probably did, but obviously I wanted to still get in the fairway and get it close to the hole. But I would always just keep biting off more than I could chew. I'd aim like not enough down the fairway. I'd aim more towards the pin because I wanted to get it by the green, and I would just always leave it in the rough. And like finally there was just some aha moments where I'd just be like, all right, this is stupid. I should literally just like try and get the ball in the fairway, and that's it. And then eventually, obviously, my skill got a little bit better and I could do it, but that was one of the things. And then I remember we would always just try
let's go back on that point real quick. Remember what you're going to say, but you watch pros play today. the Byron Nelson was on TV last week, and I watched a pro chip out of literally 90 degrees. He had no shot. Everything was trouble. Everything was going to be very penalizing. He had to chip out. And when he chipped out, he hit it to like 1 inch and made the putt for par.
Mm-hmm.
They're good, and you got to give yourself a chance to recover. I think my message back in those days was, you have no chance if you stay in the rough. You can't hit it far enough. You can't go down there and get the ball out of that rough. You're just not big and strong enough yet. Getting back in the fairway, you have a chance to move the ball. It seems demoralizing to throw that one shot away.
Yeah.
But if you make if you make an 11, it's better than 12. If you make a 10, it's better than 11.
Yep.
And you have to believe that early on. And it took years for you to believe that. But I don't care what your skill level is. If you're a dad or a golfer listening to the show, you almost have to take that medicine. And I would challenge you, the more you take the medicine, the better you're going to get.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, maybe you don't hit them in the rough or hit them in a spot where you can't get out of it. But go back to your thoughts. Sorry.
And then another thing, another little short-term goal that we would always do while I was playing is just, like, avoid bunkers, like, avoid trouble like that. And just, like, we tried to, we aimed for, like, the biggest target, sort of. And we aimed to where, like, I would be safe. Like, we aimed to the part where it just gave me the best probability to be safe. Not being a bunker, not being, like, some crazy rough, like, where I could definitely just still get the ball, like, in the hole and, like, as few strokes as possible. And things like that.
I think a thing that was a motivator in my mind, much like other golfers, I have a bunch of scratched balls in the garage that I'm never going to play with myself. But I would always bring a handful of those, maybe a bag at times, where if I knew we were playing a course, you would have a practice round or something where there would be some trouble to carry. It's hard as a 14-year-old kid to hit a 160-yard shot over a creek.
There's a lot more pressure on it too.
You try to pick up on it, you top it, it goes in the creek. But it was always fun to maybe throw down a ball, you hit in the water, throw down another ball, you got lucky and it got over. It wasn't quite a good strike. Throw down another one, you hit the pure one, and just give that confidence that, man, I can do it. I can do it. If you just hit it in the water, you never get that confidence built. I would strongly encourage that you carry a handful of old balls, give your junior golfer a chance to get over, because every time they get over, it's just going to build a little bit of a memory that I can do this. I'll never forget, we were playing at High Meadow Ranch, and it was a practice round. It was middle of the summer, but rainy a little bit. You had just got a new 5-wood. This might have been sophomore year, but you had about 200 to go. And I said, go for it. And you're like, there's no way. And I said, go for it. I think you hit it over the green. But I remember that first time that you had you'd built up enough muscle memory where I thought you could do it. I said, go for it. And you did it. It was something that you put in your mind that was made it possible, made it realistic. And something that I probably helped you get over many water hazards that you don't even remember. But keep doing it. One of the goals that I remember was fewer putts. I don't think we ever said no 3 putts or anything like that. But if you had a 4-putt on the last hole, we wanted to do a 3-putt on this hole and try to keep chopping away at that.
Yep.
Why was putting hard for you early on in golf?
I think one of the things that I think is really hard is I just never knew how to like read greens at all. And just things like that. And we would do it together, obviously. We would read greens together. And, like, you would tell me stuff, and I just wouldn't see it at all. And, like, I just wouldn't understand even kind of what was happening on, like, the green surface, you know? Like, obviously, if there was big old hills in the middle of the green, I would be able to tell you if it was up or downhill. But you would see these, like, you'd tell me it's, like, breaking 3 inches to the right or something like that. And I was like, it looks completely flat to me. And, like, I just had no feel over, like, putts like that. And, like, it was just – reading greens was a big struggle. And it's still a struggle for me now. Cause that's arguably you can – it's probably the thing I'm the worst at still. But it's just seeing those tiny little degrees of slope in the green I could never really do. And then also just, like, being able to adjust between slow and fast greens. Like, I never knew if a green was going to be fast or slow. I just kind of whack at the putt every time. And then – even if I didn't know, like after playing a couple holes and even like figuring out like they, okay, these are fast, I would really struggle with like adjusting if I played like slow greens the day before that or something. Like it was just all very, I feel like I just had a couple like mental blockades more than anything that would kind of really make me struggle with just putting and having the feel and seeing break and just all those things like that.
Yeah. Putting is either you're naturally good at it and you see it or you don't, but there's many, many tricks. And I think I made a yardstick with colors on it with electrical tape where you kind of knew what a 3-footer was, a 6-footer, 12-footer. And I think the more technical you can get, if you're not a naturally good putter, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah.
You still have to be able to let the putter swing and have a little bit of feel to it. But putting is obviously the place where people make money all day, every day.
Oh, yeah.
But you take that same concept and move to some of the bigger things that we did as we were trying to motivate you to get better. I bought many a hula hoop for you, and not so you could hula hoop. How did we use hula hoops to help make you, and this was early on, a better golfer?
We would use hula hoops just so I would kind of stop, like, I think maybe it was sort of I'd stop trying to, like, drain every single putt. Because when I would do that, I'd hit it too firm or, like, I'd just make a mistake when I was trying to make putts. But when we put a hula hoop down and you just say,
by the way, I cut hula hoops in half.
Yeah.
So we would have a half circle behind the hole.
Yeah. Or it'd be hula hoops or it'd be, like, string or something on the ground. So, like, the ball can roll over it still. But we would use a hula hoop. So it'd just be like, all right, just hit it in this 3-foot circle. You know, stop trying to, like, stop trying to just make a putt and just, like, accept, yeah, this putt probably won't go in. But, like, the best thing you can do at this point is just put it to where you can make the next one really easily. And honestly, just having that, like, little tiny mental switch where it'd be, like, from, oh, I want to make this to, oh, I want to put this inside 3 feet. It just kind of, like, made it a lot easier. And it also just, it would take some pressure off you because you're like, oh, this is a massive circle. If I miss this, then
instead,
like,
of a 4.5-inch hole.
Yeah, like it just felt, it just made it a lot easier for me, like using hula hoops and like seeing a big circle around this tiny hole, you know. And yeah,
a lot of times too, we would use hula hoops for short game chipping, where I remember like, again, like all that we did, you kept looking at the flagstick.
Yeah.
And many times when you're chipping, you don't really want to look at the flagstick. Mm-hmm. You want to look at where you want the ball to land.
Yeah.
And the, kind of what weight and pace you want the ball to land there. And I would tell you that. I'd put a tee in the ground. And you'd look at my tee for like 1 second, and then you'd look at the hole. And I'd be like, you can't look at the hole. You're going to keep trying to ram it into the hole.
Yeah.
And that's never going to work. So we started using hula hoops, and I bought other little plastic circles to where we want the ball to land in the circle. We want to try and chip it to the circle. And if we chip it to the circle with a certain amount of height to it, then you're going to have the best opportunity to get the ball close to the hole.
Yeah.
And so those were things we kept doing to motivate you to play the game kind of maybe the way the game's supposed to be played, but maybe you didn't have the knowledge yet. And each of those little goals and motivators kept making you a better golfer. At some point, we started to accomplish things in that first year.
Yep.
Let's talk through some of those accomplishments. Do you remember your first birdie?
Yep. Literally everything about it.
All right. Talk about it. Many people listening will remember this.
It was on par 3. I can say the specifics, even though no one might know, but it was on the Glen course at Glenlock Pines. It was hole 6. I remember we were just playing the men's tees, I'm pretty sure. And it was probably like 160, 170. And I wanted to hit, I think it was like a hybrid or a 5-wood or something like that. Like I was just hitting, like, I would have had to hit a perfect shot to get it 170 though with a hybrid or 5-wood back in those days. And I hit it and I hit a bad one, threw a little temper tantrum, I think. And then you're just like hit driver. And I was like, I'm not hitting driver. Like, that's just so silly. It's a par 3. I'm not hitting a driver. And you're like, just try it. Literally one time for me. Just try it. And I was just like, I kept saying no. Like I was arguing against it. I was not hitting driver on that par 3 because it was just an ego thing. But I finally folded. I finally hit the driver you asked me to hit. And I don't quite remember how close I hit it, but I probably had to hit it pretty close to it.
It was about 20 feet. You were on the right side of the green.
Oh, okay.
Back left pin, right side of the green, and you had a,
yeah,
I want to say a 20-footer breaking from right to left.
Yep. And then I just made that. And then I remember taking a photo with the ball and everything, putting a little two up, and I was just, it was a very ecstatic moment, and I was very happy that it happened. And then, yeah, I never would have thought my first birdie would have been on a par three with a driver, because that's just, yeah.
But it's something to say, like, I remember, and I'm sure many other junior golfers have the same feeling, if my friends can hit a six iron, there's no way I'm going to hit a driver.
Yeah.
The reality is the right tool is the right tool. Whatever that tool is, if you need to hit driver, hit driver. The more that you do the right thing for you, the better you're going to become as a golfer. And I think that birdie's one that stuck with us. I think about it every time I play the hole today. I think how much euphoria you had. I think about how much pride I had. And it's a great memory. And every golfer probably will have many of those memories. I remember the first time you broke 120. Like, we kept score, and we probably both shrugged a few here and there. But I always thought if we really kept score, and it took a long time before we played 18 full holes. But I remember 120 was a big number to break.
Yeah.
You had a lot of 130 rounds. We had to work hard to stay smart. One sand trap might have been 5 extra strokes. We had to do what we had to do. Yeah. But when you broke 120, it was a big deal. I remember when you broke 50 on 9 holes for the first time. 49 was a huge
accomplishment. That was a big one, yeah.
What would you do if you shot 49 today?
That'd be really bad if I did that. And I don't know what I would have to do to shoot that bad of a score. But I do remember, like, the first time I ever did it on 9 holes. That was like, dang, it was cool. Definitely cool.
It's that accomplishment, that progress, that moving forward that makes golfers come back tomorrow, yeah. Right? And you as a parent and you as a junior golfer have to give yourself some leeway to say 49 is a great score if you normally shoot over 50.
Yeah.
It's not about getting to 36 on every 9 holes. It's probably unachievable for a while, and then you got to stick with it. I know early on you wanted to make the team. We didn't know what that meant. We went to the parent conference. We hoped that there was room. You were kind of going to a new high school, so we thought there was a chance. But it turns out you made the JV team in the first year.
I did.
And the senior team didn't really have enough golfers. They had 4 or 5. And so you got the shot to play in some varsity tournaments. You got a lot of experience.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of luck involved in the way that the school was, you were going into a newer high school that only had a freshman, sophomore, and junior class. But you made the team. That was a big deal.
That was.
We bought a purple golf bag, Klein Kane, Hurricanes.
Yep.
It was a big, big deal. And the nerves, it just made the nerves worse, though, at the end of the day.
Yeah, I remember, like, tryouts and stuff I actually don't even know. Like, once again, I did get really lucky with my high school situation and, like, trying out for my freshman year, because there was not that many golfers trying out. So they were sort of, there was, like, 5 really good golfers, and that was, like, the varsity team. And then the rest of them were kind of, like, the level I was, where it was just, like, kind of getting close to breaking 100 for the first time and sort of like that. But yeah, I got very lucky with that. And then I remember tryouts, and I don't think I really like had to try out, but I do remember like first time playing with the team in front of the coaches and all that. And it was just so nerve wracking. And I literally remember my first shot. Once again, it was on a par 3, and I like just absolutely like duck hook fatted it, and it went nowhere. And it was just so embarrassing, and just little things like that just kind of added up and all of that. So, yeah.
Well, I don't know that you had to try out when that first tryout occurred. And I would say that most high schools around the country, if you want to try out, you're going to make a team. You're going to get the chance to be on the team. You're going to get the chance to practice with the team. If you're going to an elite high school for golfers, you probably won't have that opportunity. But you probably will have the opportunity to play, or at least practice with the team and give yourself a shot to do more. We'll wrap the show we'll wrap the show from the accomplishments section with the biggest thing that you did that year. What ultimately happened your freshman year of high school golf?
At the end of the year, we had a little banquet where everyone won like little awards and stuff. And I didn't even know it was an award. Like I didn't even know we were getting awards or anything like that. Like I was just like, I just thought we were eating dinner all together. Like it was just a fun little thing you do to wrap up the year. But we got awards, and then the first award that like a girl and a boy got was most improved golfer. And I remember I was just sitting there with my friend and I was like, imagine I won this right now or something like that. Cause like in my heart, I did feel like I did like improve the most out of anyone. Like I went from not being able to break 100 to I think like shooting kind of high 80s pretty consistently in my freshman year. And I was like, imagine I won this right now to my friend. And I was saying as a joke, but like I did feel like in my heart, I like won it. And then surely enough, they called my name and I won the most improved golfer award of the year, which was in my first year of high school, which was a lot of my friends didn't think it was cool. But like to me, it just definitely felt like a really cool thing to win an award that early on for like a sport that I'm still like such a beginner to, you know?
I mean, 5 years later, you're still almost beating yourself up for not winning a different award. I got to say to parents and juniors, like, to me as a dad, there was no better award that Blake could have won than the most improved golfer. It gave him kudos for all the hard work. It gave him kudos for the perseverance and determination to get better. And if it doesn't matter where you start, if you do get better, that's something to be proud of. And to be the most improved golfer on that golf team was something to be excited about. Even if there were other really good golfers, to put in that effort and to be the most improved was something that his mom and I will cherish forever. It was really, really cool. And we didn't have that as a goal, to go win the most improved golfer. And I don't think you should have that as a goal. You just need to grind every day. You need to hit one more bucket every day. Yep. And become the best golfer that you can become to win whatever award when that award comes, if you want to enjoy and keep playing the game. Today's show was called Round One. It was all about the early days. We kind of talked about getting better, having goals, and then some of the accomplishments that Blake had. You want to wrap us up today, Blake?
I will. Like you said, today's episode was called Round One. And I think this is kind of the start of a little mini-series we're going to do in this podcast. And next episode, but eventually we are going to drop an episode that's round two, and that'll sort of be kind of my sort of the middle of everything and so on and so forth. And yeah, like you said, we talked about getting better, having goals, accomplishments, and I think everyone's goal should just definitely be go out and hit one more bucket and work as hard as you can to become what you want to become.
Until next week, go hit that one more bucket.
Do it.
You just caught one more bucket with Blake Doss and his dad, Bobby Doss. For more about Blake, including how to get private lessons scheduled now, go to blakedoss.com. And we'll catch you next time right here on the One More Bucket podcast.